this root ignorance, and we looked at that. That came up at the top of several flip chart pages, this ignorance. And it's an ignorance about the way things really exist, right? So Buddhism says when we're under the control of that ignorance, there's a dichotomy between the way things appear to us and the way they exist. But we believe that appearance. We don't realize that there's a dichotomy. We believe that things exist exactly the way that they appear. So wisdom means, you know, closing that gap to the point where we see the ultimate nature of reality. We see things exactly the way they appear. We see things as empty of inherent existence. That is the ultimate nature of reality. And so in Buddhism, we talk a lot about emptiness. It doesn't mean nothingness. It doesn't mean things don't exist. And let's use Alex Berzin, the translator's words, devoidness of impossible ways of existing. Okay? Because that really explains what emptiness is. Emptiness, probably next to karma, the most misunderstood topic in Buddhism, as people think if they understand emptiness, oh, nothing matters, nothing really exists, we're all kind of walking around in this big collective hallucination, you know, the goal of the path is to merge with like some black hole or something, like all kinds of weird views. Some came from really early bad translations. The void, capital V. Right? Like the void. Emptiness is a quality of every existing thing. So there's no parallel universe or some like outside reality of emptiness. And then there's like conventional reality and then there's empty reality. We say emptiness is a characteristic of every existing thing. You can't talk about emptiness without talking about the phenomenon which is qualified by the characteristic of emptiness. Okay, so don't worry. I know that's a lot. I'll unpack slowly. But just to say, this is empty of inherent existence. The bell is empty. All of my plethora of drinks and snacks are empty of inherent existence. They're empty of impossible ways of existing. And the impossible way of existing is existing from their own side, by their own nature, in exactly the way they appear to us. Okay? So I'll unpack what that means. And the easiest way of understanding emptiness is by understanding dependent arising, right? Because we say, because things are empty of inherent existence or existing from their own side, because they're dependent on other factors. Independent existence, inherent existence, would mean they don't exist independent on any other factors. So we say dependent arising and emptiness are like two sides of a coin. They're like two ways of looking at exactly the same thing. One is by what is lacking, any kind of independent or inherent existence, right? And one is showing how it does exist, independence on other factors. So that's what I want to help you understand emptiness by explaining dependent arising. And we'll go through it and go through it and go through it. So if you're completely lost, join the club. We'll get there. We've still got an hour and a half. Okay? I will take you there, I promise. So let's look at dependent arising. And then it'll make what I've been talking about clearer. So we're going to go back here. So we talk about three levels of dependent origination or dependent arising. One of my friends, we're talking about translations, and I have a friend who is this British monk who studied like all the way. He got a Geshe degree, which is like the highest level of degree in the Tibetan philosophical system. And he really prefers dependent relativity. So he's translated a couple of, and he insists on dependent relativity, but you'll hear dependent origination or dependent arising a lot. a lot more than dependent relativity. I hate to say it, especially Graham Woodhouse, but dependent relativity is not quite caught on, but you'll hear all of these. So I'm going to use the cup as one of my many cups as the example of dependence on these three levels. So increasing levels of subtlety. The first two, pretty easy to figure out. The last one, the subtlest one, we'll spend some time on that. So here's a cup, a Pete's coffee cup. Right? So we say that this cup is not inherently existent. It's not independently existent. It's empty of any kind of inherent existence, because it's dependent on all three of these levels for its existence. Okay? And those are mutually exclusive. If something were independent, it couldn't be dependent on other factors. Right? That's just logic. Anything that's independent of other factors wouldn't be dependent on all of these factors. So the first factor is the causes and conditions. And so for a material object like this, we say the causes is the stuff that goes into becoming the cup. So the clay, some kind of glaze, paint, just the material stuff in Tibetan, it's called nyerlin hikyu. It's like the material cause, right? So the clay, the glazes, whatever that stuff. And then the conditions are talking about how did all of those raw materials transform into the cup, right? So somebody had to dig the clay out of the ground, and then there was a factory that manufactured. I mean, it's not handmade. It was made in some factory, so there were machines and people working in the factory and somebody stamping or painting Pete's coffee and, putting the clay. So that whole process is the condition. So the causes, the material stuff, and the whole process. So this cup's existence is dependent on all of those causes and conditions. Super easy to understand. Everybody with me so far? Causes and conditions. Easy as what? Now, this cup's existence, it exists in dependence on parts. So this cup is a cylinder with a bottom and a handle, and kind of a non-part, an opening here, right? So this cup exists in dependence on its component parts. All of them need to be there to be a cup. If it were just a cylinder, it would just be some weird ceramic tube. What the hell is that? If it were just the bottom, it might make a nice coaster to put the cup on so you don't ruin your furniture. The handle by itself, I won't even go there. I have no idea what that would be. So this cup depends on all the component parts as well, right? So it doesn't exist independently of the parts. Also easy. Done with number two. Number three is the kicker, okay? So we say that this cup's existence depends on conceptual imputation or designation. Is the philosophical word. And this is the way this works. So stay with me. I'll go through it a couple of times. So there's a cylinder with a bottom and a handle, right? So the way our perception works is my eye sense consciousness makes contact with the raw data of these colors and shapes, right? So the cylinder, the bottom, the handle, the opening. I have a mental image cup. We call it, sometimes it's translated as generic image, sometimes translated as meaning generality. It's just my concept cup. It's kind of like a kid's picture book. You know, in kids' books, like apple, cow, ball. So I got cup. And it's just like this. That's my generic image, my mental image of cup. Called generic, super generic, right? So when I perceive the raw data, it almost instantaneously. It's been measured electrically, something like 9 nanoseconds, matches with a concept, and then I label this cylinder cup, right? So far, so good, no problem at all. But in the next instant, it seems like it's a cup from its own side, by its own nature, independent of my conceptual imputation or my designation. Okay? So let's go through it again. Raw data, generic image, child's picture book cup, matches on and labels this object cup. No problem. So far, so good. But it seems that there's a cup from its own side, by its own nature, independent of that labeling process. And everybody now is like, Tenzin-Tofu, you have lost your mind. Of course it's a cup. What are you talking about? How could it be a cup just independent on my conceptual imputation? But that's how everything exists. That's how we're perceiving everything. Nothing has independent or inherent existence. Nothing exists from its own side, independent of that labeling process. Right? So, who cares about the cup? It's nice. I'm glad it's here, along with my plethora of other beverage options. But I don't really care. I'm not going to have attachment or aversion. What happens about the object of attachment or the object of aversion, right? So we perceive the annoying person. They're annoying from their own side, by their own nature, completely independently, completely inherently. I haven't created that perception at all, right? They're just like that. And anybody who doesn't see them as annoying is crazy. So, what about the objects of our mental affliction? They're also empty of any quality that we ascribe to them. We're ascribing that quality to them independent on raw data. Now, the raw data may be certain things they say to us, but not everybody would find that annoying, right? Not everybody. It's like if the enemy were the enemy from their own side, by their own nature, they'd be the enemy to everybody. They wouldn't have one friend. Nobody would see them as a stranger. They'd just be the enemy from their own side. So this explains how our perception works and why things appear the way they do to us. And we insist on our own appearance, and the people around us are perceiving something different. And there's different levels of subjectivity. But not every human being on the planet would even perceive this as a cup, right? You can think of some uncontacted tribe in Papua New Guinea. What do they drink water out of? Probably not something that looks like this. If they encountered this, they might label it something completely different. Anybody remember that movie from the 80s?
Yeah.
The perfect example. Do you young people know what I'm talking about? So there's this San Bushman in the middle of the Kalahari Desert, right? And so this empty Coke bottle falls out of this plane and bonks him on the head. He's never seen a Coke bottle. There's no Coke within 500 miles of the Kalahari Desert, right? It's a low-flying plane. Chucks out an empty Coke bottle. So he takes it back to his village. And then the whole narrative of the story is like, they use it as a rolling pin, and then somebody's using it as a weapon to bonk each other, and then they're fighting over it. We're all going, ha, 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 it's a Coke bottle. Look what they're doing with the Coke bottle. It's a green glass cylinder, for God's sake. It's not a Coke bottle. It's a Coke bottle because we have that generic image. He has a generic image of rolling pin, and uses it to make chapatis or whatever the Kalahari Desert equivalent of. You know, and the whole movie is hilarious, mostly because we have the ignorance thinking it's really a Coke bottle. I was imagining watching that movie with the Dalai Lama, he'd be like, what? Yeah. Like, you know, the whole narrative. we're doing that all the time, right? We're doing that all the time. And it can be innocuous. And is it a cell phone or is it a gun? And is it dependent on who's holding it? And what color are they? And are they wearing a hoodie? And what neighborhood are they running through? Cops see guns. There have been studies done, non-Buddhist, on implicit bias. And if you're primed, if your implicit bias is primed, you will more readily, if there's like an image shown, a split-second image, you'll see a gun. And it's a wrench or something. So that's because it's empty of inherent existence, right? And so your mind is, that mental image in your mind, that generic image, there's a lot that that's associated with. And so that's, I mean, that's the extreme of how it gets us in trouble. The friend, enemy, stranger thing is one realm. And that's the extreme of our mind is, and we say after that first moment of perception, we're relating to our mental image and not what's there anymore. We're not even seeing. We've decided. Right? And we're relating to our mental image and not even, we're not even perceiving the wrong data anymore. So that's why it's so hard for us to change our labeling of things, you know, after the fact, right? So understanding this concept of emptiness, and this is one of the things, it's not that hard to understand intellectually, but to train yourself to close that gap between the appearance and your belief in how those things exist takes thousands of hours of meditation to have what we call a direct realization of emptiness, where you directly see the complete lack of inherent existence. Thousands of hours. But even just understanding it, even just questioning appearances. And remember I said way back when we were talking about disturbing emotions and mental affliction. Question those appearances, right? You can do that right now, today, right? Long before you're going to have that actual direct realization. Yeah, one second. I have one more thing to explain, and then we can have questions. Long before you have that direct perception of emptiness, you can start to question, especially if you have a strong emotional reaction to something. Question. How am I appearing, you know, how am I perceiving that? And what's my projection or my imputation onto that whole situation? Now, one more thing I want to explain, and then I know that there's a million questions. So, if things are dependent on conceptual imputation or designation, how come we all see similar enough things that we can even communicate at all? Right? Like we've all got our own minds full of whatever our... How can we even have any consensual reality at all? And so we say, consensual reality, one of my teachers, Sonsar Khyentse Rinpoche, explains it really nicely, and he says, it's based on, like, this is a cup. It's a cup. It's fine. We can call this a cup. It's not a cup from its own side, but it's a cup. Dependent on function, consensus, and continuity, right? So, apart from the uncontacted tribes in Papua New Guinea and the San Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert, most modern human beings on this planet would identify this as a cup. So there's certain consensus there. It's like a concentric circle of consensual shared labeling based on the function, right? We call a small-ish cylinder with the function of holding liquid for me to drink, right? We call cup. And then there's a certain continuity, because even though that cup is changing moment by moment by moment, there's enough continuity that I can say, oh, could you get the cup that I was drinking from yesterday? It's not the same cup on that subtle level, but until I hurl it against the wall and break it, which would make Lauren really upset or break the window. You know, until I destroy it, there's a certain continuity. And so function, consensus and continuity is how things exist conventionally and why we can talk about things like the Pete's coffee cup and communicate with each other and talk about Brandy and David and Lauren, right? All just labeled by our minds. But I often think of it as like there's concentric circles of shared reality. All human beings on the planet would probably call the liquid in this cup water, right? They have that shared consensual reality. And then there's smaller circles of shared consensus. How many people could walk in here, for example, and identify, in fact, Susan the other day, identify the pictures on the altar, right? The colors and shapes. How many people have the generic images to be able to identify, oh, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Lama Yet, right? So that's another concentric circle. So you find that, like shared perceptions, right, dependent on what's your concentric circle? What are your generic images? What are they matching up to out there? So don't be a perceptual chauvinist and insist that your perception is the right one, because everybody has their own unique perception, and somebody from another culture might have a completely different label for a certain object and a completely different reality going on that they share with another group of people, right? So it's always really good to think in terms of just questioning and really, really, like, I think that's why my friend loves the definition of dependent relativity, right? Because it's relative to so many other factors. What things are is relative to so many other factors, okay? So questions. You had a question.
We were talking before, it made me think on a schizophrenia or madness.
Yeah.
As the extreme of that, when they lose reality, but they still get their own ideas of something.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Or a small example would be like when you hear a song, and that song was from your boyfriend or husband or something, and then you attach it so much,
that's right.
As small as that, it just can ruin your moment or your day or something, just because you have that idea.
That's right.
Head.
All these
now
attachments.
It changes the past.
Yeah.
Loves your
all
reality.
Yeah. Yeah. So different. We can see there's so many examples of like different realities, different perceptions. I was just thinking about a dog in this room, right? So a being of a different realm of existence, the karma of being a dog. So the generic images, and I'm not going to disrespect Bandit, but David has this standard poodle called Bandit. If Bandit came in this room right now, I don't know who's met Bandit, he would recognize his dad. So he has the generic image dad. You might remember me. I've met him a couple of times and given him enough treats that may be. And then it would just be like snacks. The people I know, would he be going, wow, look at that amazing Tonka, white Tara. Like, no way. So I just sometimes think of the animal realm. We used to have a goat in our center in New Zealand, and they used to think, then he has three generic images. You know, can I eat it? Is it going to eat me? Or can I mate with it? Pretty basic generic images, right? That it's perceiving everything. And people with different, like for sure mental illness, different realms of existence, even just, like you say, our own personal histories, right, determine what we perceive. You know, our training, our personal histories, whatever, it is completely determined. Musicians, artists, this friend of mine from Brazil was visiting, and some of you met him Sunday morning. He looked at Brandy's daughter's artwork. I just look at her artwork and I just go, whoa, you're 19, I can't believe. He looks at her artwork, and because of this artistic training, he perceives things that I don't even perceive. Like he's perceiving qualities of these lines. And I just go, whoa, drumming, you're amazing. He's like, look, the mindfulness in this line, right? many examples of our perception completely determined by, you know, our generic images. And in a case like that, because of like decades of training, you will actually perceive different things. You know, art historians would come in here and like, who knows? You know, I can identify the deities, but like a real artist. So it's really interesting to think of that in terms of the perception. But how it gets us in trouble with the friend, enemy, stranger, with the cell phone being perceived as a gun, all of those things. So keeping that emptiness in mind, but not going to the extreme of saying, oh, it doesn't exist, or I'll just make it up. Anything could be anything. If things are dependent on conceptual imputation, I'll just decide I'm a Buddha now. It'll save my knees. So straight of hours of meditation. I'll just decide. Because it doesn't work like that. Your conceptual imputations are forced on you by your karma. They're forced, and that's what it means to be a dog. You're born in the dog realm, and you have those perceptions which are forced on you by your karma. So it's not about wishful thinking. Sorry. You know? Full disclosure. It's not about just deciding or wishful thinking. It's about changing your karma to the point where everything is amazing. Remember we talked about the qualities of the Buddha last time. Sometimes the wrong view of emptiness is, oh, things are empty. I can do whatever I want. Nothing really matters. There's this famous story of Joanna Macy, this Buddhist teacher, was at this Buddhist conference. I think I might have told the story to you. Did I tell the story about the suitcases at the Buddhist conference yet? Okay, couldn't remember. So she's at this Buddhist conference, and it was the old days where you had to turn in the hotel key instead of just like swiping something across. I can never do it right. No, I just went through there. So it was like, so everybody's turning in their key, and this woman who'd been at the Buddhist conference, and she's standing in front of Joanna Macy, and her suitcase drops and pops open, and it's full of hotel towels. And she says, oh, but everything's empty, so it doesn't matter. Completely wrong view. Because things are empty, your karma and your ethics matters more than you ever thought that it did, because it is creating your reality. So you want everything to be beautiful and amazing? Watch your vows. Avoid the 10 non-virtues. Clean up your act karmically and watch the fireworks. This great Tibetan master who actually came from India to Tibet, Padmasambhava, this like, you know, sometimes attributed to starting Buddhism in Tibet, used to say, my mind is as vast as the sky and my actions are as fine as flowers. So really, really being mindful of your actions because things are empty and you want to create the cause to force your conceptual imputations as a nation to be amazing. Because the annoying person is not annoying from their own side. You are creating that through your karma, that perception of that person. The words that they're saying are being perceived by you. Right? And that's the difference in the different realms of existence, and that's the difference in a Buddhist perception versus ours. Human beings are kind of medium. It's pretty good. I mean, it's better than dog reality, no disrespect to bandit, you know, but it could get a whole lot better than medium, you know, so only by watching our karma. And so one great master, Chogyam Rinpoche, who was teaching around in California for a number of years. He passed away about, I think it was about 4 years ago. And someone asked him once, I was in a teaching with him, and someone asked him, what are the qualities of a good teacher? And in the Lamrim text, there are 10 qualities of a teacher. And I was expecting him to go into this whole list of the 10 qualities. And he said, a good teacher teaches you the relationship between karma and emptiness. And I was like, wow, I've never heard that as like the answer to that question, because somebody was saying, how do you know if you found a trustworthy teacher? And he's like, they teach that relationship, because it's so important. Fernando.
I'll try to get your take, on the sequence here. Somebody's walking out and about. We all carry our baggage. So our generic images are tainted, you know, tainted with whatever we bring to the table. So our implicit bias would increase the chances of seeing something for what it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Then the reaction, then thinking you see that, would sort of increase the implicit bias, or just to act on it. Like say that the cell gun.
The cell phone gun. So it's kind of like that implicit. I think, you know, in relation to emptiness, and I think about this, and implicit bias is something they talk about in psychology and sociology. But when I think about it, I think that implicit bias is even distorting our perception of the raw data. Right, and then we're reacting to our what we did in fact see because of that distortion, right? That was caused by that implicit bias, and then we reacted. So there's ways to uproot implicit bias. I mean, psychologists talk about lots and lots of ways to uproot. Like Harvard University has a website that you can test your implicit bias. And then retrain that by having positive associations. They have, you know, implicit bias for Muslims and women and people of color of all kinds and all of this stuff. And you can test where you're in. And by implicit bias, I mean you're not a member of the KKK. You don't think you're racist, for example, at all. But you do have that implicit bias shows up. So it can be retrained. So I think when we realize that there's something like that going on, that especially that's motivating our behavior, we can change that generic image. They're not permanent. We can create a new generic image. So I think that would be the emptiness explanation of how to do that.
So how would you compare that to? It's pretty close to, say, you walk in the woods and you know there's snakes there.
Yeah.
So if you hear a little rustle.
Yeah.
You're patrolling and you're walking around or you're doing your job and you're another version of you're walking in the woods and
yeah.
The chances are that if something pops up it's going to be something dangerous.
And I'm not saying don't label at all, but we need to look at when are our labels distorted and when are our labels dangerous. I was bitten by a rattlesnake. I said for years after that, every stick was a snake, and I was jumping out of my skin because of that experience I had. So the point is not to wipe out all the labels at all, right? But the point, I mean, the Dalai Lama labels things. The Dalai Lama perceives the cup, the water. The Buddhas perceive things conventionally the way they exist. But I think our, especially when it comes to the distortion that are at the root of a lot of our disturbing emotions. That's when we can retrain, you know, and become really aware. But it's not about wiping out the labels. I mean, the Buddhas aren't just like, you know, waiting to be spoon-fed because they perceive food or what. You know, we function. In fact, function even better and see things more and more accurately, you know, as we work with these ideas. Without the distorted exaggerations, like that's the point. Great question. Yeah, Howard.
So it sounds like this leads right back to empathy and compassion too, because we see things as we want to see them. We attach labels. We attach our vision, our version, our movie in our head to something, but so often we don't have the other perspective, a different perspective. We only have our own perspective that we've attached to it.
You bet.
So it limits our ability to be compassionate and have empathy because we're not walking in the cup's shoes.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So it opens us up to a greater living.
Because we so insist that our perception is the right one.
Well, it's my movie.
Which leads to every kind of judgment and, you know, oh, everything. You're absolutely right, Howard. I mean, all of those kind of problems just come from believing that my appearance is reality and everybody else is wrong. Or oh, how on earth did that person do that? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really a key. And we say, like, it, you know, this is Sunil's favorite kind of metaphor, like the two wings of a bird, compassion and wisdom, the wisdom seeing things the way they are, informs our compassion. Our compassion moistens that wisdom, and we need both of them for the path. But exactly as you pointed out, you really see how that wisdom really informs that compassion side too. Gives it the kind of the weight behind it. It just doesn't come this mushy thing, but it's actually got wisdom kind of underlying it, which makes it so much stronger than just this sort of wimpy, oh, just be nice to everybody. I don't know why, because you're supposed to. So, you know, questioning. Yeah.
So I get that the cup is empty because it doesn't know that it's a cup. It's only a cup because I say it's a cup. I attach it as a cup. But can you speak to an organic, speak to a human, like, I know I'm Howard and you know I'm Howard. So am I still empty?
You bet you are. There's nothing that's not empty. Nothing exists from its own side. There's no phenomenon that's inherently existent, including Buddhas, including enlightenment, including emptiness itself. Emptiness itself is empty of inherent existence. So you definitely are.
So just because a thing can see out, can see itself from it.
Yeah. Let's take a break, and I want to pick up on that coming back because I'll give it, because you reminded me of another great example of how emptiness helps. So let's pick up on that, but we're a little bit overdue. Yeah, go ahead.
More. So she's going to be coming for the 10th and the 17th, and then after her, Emily Sue will be teaching for a month. She comes the week after and stays till the middle of May, and then Venable calls in. So then I'm sure Venable knows them both and can say wonderful things to you.
Fabulous. Don't miss them. They're both really good friends.
I'll start
a lineup.
Yes.
Very all-star lineup.
Yeah. And then David Drabble is starting teaching meditation on Mondays next week, right?
Yeah.
And so Venerable Tenzin has been talking about different meditations, Tonglen, four powers of purification. It sounds like David is showing up in whatever the class wants, he's kind of willing to do, is what I heard. That was my perception of what I heard David say. So, but if you are interested in the meditations, I think David is a really long-time meditator and has a lot of practice under his belt, and so he could help set up a daily practice, help you with different practices that might help, and so definitely utilize him as a great resource Monday night, 6:30 to 8:30. And then Heather over there, she's teaching a class on death, rebirth, and other realms that's starting, I believe, April 28th.
Yeah.
The last Wednesday in April.
25th.
April 25th, 6:30 to 8:30. And that's a 10-week course. It goes until the last week in June. And I think that's it, because you're in the middle of a class, right?
No, that starts next week, right?
Oh, can you talk about your class that you're starting next week?
Yeah, so we'll be starting a four-class series called Listening as a Spiritual Practice based on nonviolent communication. And the idea is just when we can really slow down and listen and open and receive another person, kind of like receive the experience fully, you know, can we do that?
Yeah.
Regardless of whether we agree with them or not, whether we like what they're saying or not, but how much, so just practicing that, not that it's easy to do, but we practice.
And I
was just going off Howard's comment, how I was thinking that when you made your comment about how it's almost this merging of the bodhicitta piece, the compassion piece, and the emptiness, like how to open and actually see and listen and hear. So it's almost like
wisdom and action.
That's on Thursday, starting, not this Thursday, the 12th of April.
6:30.
Oh, 6:30. Same channel.
And then finally, I'm really excited to announce that Reverend Brian Baker is going to be coming to do a class. Well, not a class. We're still talking about what exactly it's going to look like, but he wants to do a conversation about social justice and really talk about how we explore within ourselves what social justice is and how we want to get involved at our personal levels, like what we're able to do and how we're able to do it. He is an amazing speaker, incredibly inspiring. He's not a Tibetan Buddhist. He is, I think, Episcopalian? He's an Episcopalian minister, and he's phenomenal. He's going to be coming Friday, April 27th. And so if you could come, like, just come. Just be here. Just be here and bring everyone you know. So, yeah, we'll have flyers hopefully next week. We're still working out the details of what it's going to be about. So,
thank you.
Huh?
Okay. Two, I want to open up for some more questions. Two more things before we open up to more questions, because Howard's question right before the break reminded me of this piece that I wanted to emphasize, how understanding the emptiness of inherent existence helps us with our disturbing emotions from an example that happened in my life. And I wish I could remember what happened, because it would make a way better story, and I don't. But anyway, I did something that, because it was me that did it, was probably some pretty dysfunctional attempt to try and find happiness and avoid suffering, fumbling around as usual, pretty benign, probably. One person in my life, this one friend of mine, thought it was the most heinous, selfish act of the most self-absorbed jerk in the world. Another person in my life thought it was the enlightened activity of an emanation of the Buddha. You know, my karma is kind of medium. I'm like, whatever. And I remember in that moment when this one guy like lit into me, and then this other person has this completely different view. I was like, oh my God, it's Brandy, I used to say, proof of emptiness. Like, complete proof of emptiness. The guy who thought I was horrible, instead of feeling angry at him, I felt this incredible compassion, because I was like, poor thing. What a distorted view of this pretty benign action. His karma forced him to see it as this horrible thing. So instead of being angry at him, I just felt incredible compassion. Because he kind of saw everything that way. It was like the glass is half empty and the water's pretty funky and you want to drink it anyway. That was just sort of how he rolled. And so instead of being upset, I was like, God, what a drag. And then the other person who saw me as just, you know, clearly all my actions were enlightened and I was just her greatest teacher, instead of being like, maybe she's right. Maybe I really am a Buddha. You know, instead of feeling pride, I was like, that must be nice to see everything as so pure and perfect. Wow, how cool is that? So instead of feeling pride, I just saw that both of these people, their karma was forcing them to have this perception. My medium karma is forcing me to have some. Who's right? Nobody and everybody. There's raw data of whatever I did. But is it a horrible act? Is it just a clueless act? Or is it an enlightened act? Like, it depends on the perceiver. Right? So that's super interesting. And I remember in that moment when that happened, it was a long time ago, going, oh, somehow this emptiness stuff has landed enough that it really helped me in that moment not get upset at this situation or proud or anything else, right? So that's one thing. So think of that. Like, especially when you don't like what someone says about you, it's their karma. Don't worry about it. You know, it will of course take feedback from other people, but don't let it get you so wound up, you know, what other people perceive about what you're doing. Just try to tune into your own integrity and what you feel is the right thing to do, and just do it, and just don't even worry about it. Because I've got news for you, being a recovering black belt people pleaser, that doesn't work either. You try and make everyone like you and it doesn't work, so just forget it. Because the very things that you do to try and get everybody to like you, half the people think you're an asshole because of that. So don't even worry about it. Just do the right thing. You know, so anyway, that's my advertisement. Overcoming disturbing emotions. And then another tip is I was talking during the break, and a tip for, like, loosening our solid concrete perception. And this is a trick I found, I heard from my friend Venerable Rene, the Swiss monk. And I really learned this trick from him, and it's so helpful. And he says, like, pick an object that you encounter multiple times a day. A cup, your computer, you know, your chair, whatever it is. And he said, every time you encounter that object, and it's got to be one that you encounter all the time, he says, go through in your mind these three levels. You don't have to sit cross-legged and close your eyes. You can be sitting in your cubicle at work. They'll be thinking you're thinking deep thoughts. That's awesome. Go through in your mind. Oh, causes and conditions. The clay, the factory, parts, cylinder, bottom, handle. Right, just deconstruct in your mind. How is this dependent on these three levels? And then go through, especially spend the time on that last one. Raw data, generic image, imputed, designated on the raw data, and then it seems to be existing from its own side. So going through that with one object, it sort of bleeds out to other ones. It starts to loosen that strong fixation that you have. You know, so those two practices really reminding yourself, especially when you're in a situation where you're receiving feedback or some situation is happening that's upsetting you, you know, reminding yourself and then just doing that exercise with an object that you encounter multiple times a day can be cool, can be helpful. Other questions? Any? Yes, Susan.
I'm not exactly sure how to apply causes and conditions to parts. This is a situational encounter with another person that I knew was coming up. I had this appointment to see this person, and I knew what it was going to be about, and so I found myself categorizing, conceptualizing, writing a story, and then caught it and went, you know, I don't know. You know, I do know what the subject is going to be, but that's all I know. But I had this tremendous need to categorize, to categorize what was going to happen as if it had already happened, to categorize the person that I was meeting and the kind of meeting, just all these categories required to do that. And fortunately able to catch that that's what was happening. But somehow, the causes and conditions and parts all, and I don't know how it feeds into that, but I know it does, but I don't know how it feeds into that. Because what was happening was that encounter was, I was putting form to it. Really didn't exist.
Yeah, and I think part of it is knowing this, just noticing how we, like, so compulsively need to kind of label and designate. And like you say, even before it's even happened, we've already decided all of it. And just, you know, it's not that we don't label things. That's just the way our perception works. We have an omnipresent mental factor called discernment, which means that labeling quality. But looking at the times that it's exaggerated or distorted, or you're really insisting on labeling something, instead of just going, like, kind of a more basic level of labeling, conversation between two people, you're putting all of these extra layers on top of it, right? So I think part of it is knowing that. Can we strip some of that exaggeration down? You know, looking at the reification, looking at the exaggeration, and really strip it down to something that's closer to just kind of the raw data or the very basic level of labeling, rather than all of the narrative that you put on top and then believe that that's reality. Can we do that so much of the time? And then we believe, like, we put on multiple layers of conceptual imputation, we're all the way up here, and we're thinking that's reality, rather than just trying to look, you know, kind of more at a basic level.
So then you, could I have, or was I maybe even, without knowing it, stripping away the made-up causes and conditions and the made-up parts?
Well, it's kind of more the made-up conceptual imputation. Like, because we say we impute onto the parts. Like the parts is the basis for our imputation.
Okay.
Right? So it's more about, I mean, the parts are dependent on the causes and conditions, but it's more about the relationship here we're imputing onto the parts. Right? But then how much level of storyline do you get into? You know, but, you know, I find noticing my almost compulsion and the discomfort that comes when I can't label something. Yeah. Like, I think about it in terms of gender. If there's someone whose gender I can't identify, like a gender fluid person, I notice my mind trying so hard to decide what their gender is. And I can't let it go and go like gender fluid. No, my mind, I mean, I have that label now that I have that language as of 4 years ago or whatever. But it's like so interesting how your mind, it
that's
just keeps
adding,
right? To try and label and just really releasing that and going human being or whatever the, you know, the more basic level is. And I find that, I find when I'm perceiving something I don't have a label for, it's almost like this, it drives you nuts. Until you, like, just seeing the raw data, you're like, no, a garbage, what is it? You know, and you're just like, oh, it's so
like
interesting. Yeah, exactly. Like some, this happened to me when I was in this long retreat, and like, Sony or whoever invents these things had invented MP3 technology. Like, I went into this long meditation retreat in March of 2000, and to record Dharma teachings, you needed 2 90-minute tapes and one of those huge console things, and then there was somebody to flip, like every 45 minutes, flip really quick, and you'd lose half a sentence, and then you're trying to, you know. And then suddenly I came out of retreat in like July of 2006. And they're passing up to the front of the room these reincarnated cigarette lighters and TV remote controls. And it was like MP3. I didn't know what they were. Nobody had, like, filled me in on everything. I felt like Rip Van Winkle. But I had a label of small electronic object. I didn't have the label MP3 recorder yet. But I knew, I mean, I had a more basic label of small electronic recording device that I can't figure out how it works because they don't flip anything in it. Like, it just goes for 90 minutes or something. Right? So it's like sometimes we have a more basic label, but noticing how your mind has this almost compulsion to label. And just trying to hang out with that place and just noticing it helps everything loosen, I find. Yeah. I don't know if that helped. Yeah.
You know, it seems like every new app or something that comes out, like, what is this thing? How do I use this thing? And it's like this uncomfortable feeling until I get the concepts down and I understand and navigate it. It seems to play into that.
The
other thing that came to mind as you were speaking was that in Marshall Rosenberg talks about, you know, the first step is separating observation from evaluation. So he says, see if you can translate the, you know, like, my neighbor did this, you know, to what would a camera observe? Because a camera sees the actions objectively. If you can do that work, and you've already had to work with a lot of storyline. So, instead of saying somebody's lazy, or, you know, he would say, this person doesn't, you know, did not do this thing after they say, you know, so it becomes very specific. So he's cleaning up. He really stresses. And that's
all
the first step.
Levels. So it's sort of like stripping down all of the extra imputation down to the basic raw data.
As much as possible. But, I mean, that's the theory, and it's hard work.
That's
easy to talk about.
Yeah.
The practice is hard.
And it really, and that's the key, really is practice. why I recommended this thing of the cup or the computer or whatever it is, and doing it over and over and over again. And then you really do notice a facility with loosening and, like, stripping away. It just comes a lot easier. Like, the whole thing is just a lot looser. Like, all of this, like, concrete solidity, it just breathes space into it. And not that you're not appropriately labeling things according to their function. Like I said, the point is not to strip away the labeling at all. It's just really about examining the distortion, labeling things appropriately, realizing that they can change. I was talking to someone during the break, and we're talking about implicit bias being redefinable and how malleable it is. You know, psychologists give all kinds of recommendations about how to really deal with, if you feel that you have some kind of implicit bias, how to retrain it. So luckily, we're always getting new generic images. Things are very changeable, you know, in our own mind in terms of our conceptual imputations. There's nothing about it that's solid, concrete, and fixed. Luckily, in some of these techniques, like strip away to what would a camera see? I mean, I love that. That's awesome, because then it's a little bit more objective and not this intense subjectivity of believing your conceptual imputation is the only reality. Yeah. Yeah, Ivan.
When on certain strings, can you become denied? If it's something that is pertinent, and we just want to switch the mentality or the judgment of it. But
remember, I said you can't just switch it. You can't just switch it. You can't, I mean, yes, there is.
What you're seeing as something.
Well, there's another technique in Tibetan Buddhism that we call lojong, or thought transformation. But it's about changing your response, trying to see even the hardships in our life as some kind of a lesson. But it doesn't mean you're not experiencing it as harm. That's the difference. Because the experience, yes, certain things function as harm. Like, for sure, that's not saying it's not harm. That's not what I'm saying. And then the Lojong teachings say, can you use even those experiences somehow as a teaching or as some kind of... So this isn't saying go into denial and just try and pretend that things aren't the way that you're experiencing them, right? Mm-hmm. But it's just saying, how much am I adding on to that? And it could be a different experience for somebody else, possibly, you know, and just introducing that. But again, it's not that we're trying to wipe out the function. Thank goodness I can drink water from this because I'm thirsty. It functions as that. Even though it's empty of inherent existence, it still completely validly functions. People harm other people. That functions, but it's empty of inherent existence, right? So it's not wiping out all of our labeling. Yeah.
Could you also say that it supports living with a comfort, developing comfort with ambiguity?
Yeah. Awesome.
That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah. Just that space of holding, hey, my perception of the whole story, and my perception of things could change, and somebody else could be perceiving exactly the thing in a really different way, and all of that. Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of say out loud, I find it very challenging between, you know, when I'm identifying, oh, he's a jerk, right?
Yeah.
And he's actually doing things to sabotage, you know, my career or my professional path.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, wait a minute, what am I perceiving? Don't do that. And the balance between there could be definite reality if what somebody's doing, because that exists, right? That's an equivalent of me being, I can't be blind to the fact that if I walk up to a pit bull, oh, no, he's going to be fine. No. There's the possibility that those two things exist. So with people, I find it like, trying to separate my view from it, from how much is reality that is actually happening that I actually have to protect myself, whether it be a dog or an individual is intentionally looking at doing harm. Not somebody with a gun pointed at me. But there's other levels of harm, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it's not about being stupid and blind and not protecting yourself enough, but it's saying, is he a jerk from his own side? Everybody sees him that way. There's nobody who doesn't see him that way. We're labeling that on their actions towards you, right? That action of harm towards you. But the mistake is in saying that's the be-all and end-all of that person's identity, and everybody would see him like that. And I mean, it's dependent on actions that you perceive that person as harming you. But it's sort of stripping away the extra exaggeration that says, oh, he is a jerk from his own side. Like, he treats everybody like that, and everybody sees him like that. Like, we don't think that, but we perceive that. So this is saying, on the basis of certain ways that this person treats me, I'm labeling him in this way, but it's in dependence on this action, and there's more to the story than just that. But it doesn't mean just be a passive doormat and accept harm and go, oh, it's empty and my mind is just making it up. No, we have to, you know, be smart in the world and protect ourselves and all of that, but it's just about imputing more onto it. And what I've explained to you, I mean, this is such a big topic and takes lots and lots of study. It's very subtle. How things, we say that it's like a razor's edge between two extremes, and one is to say that nothing exists, and one extreme is everything exists in exactly the way it appears. And just getting that very, very subtle razor's edge of things do exist conventionally, but not one iota of inherent existence, it takes a lot of study and a lot of meditation to really get that balance right. So I just urge you, if you're interested, you know, some of the readings in the packet, there's a suggested reading list at the end, will help give you more information. Because in an hour, you know, no way to do justice to this incredible subtle subject, but exactly those questions that you're raising. We don't want to go to the extreme of just being stupid and discounting our perceptions either, but it's just about painting them in this way that's so solid and concrete and immutable and, you know, just perceiving somebody kind of unilaterally on the basis of just a certain behavior that they're doing towards you. Does that help a little bit? Yeah. I don't want you to be getting bit by the bully.
I used it then. I'm like, okay, so the reality is I've got to balance the two, right? I can't be a doormat.
Yeah.
I also can't be, you know, the rabid dog against it.
Yeah. And it is getting that balance, you know, and I'm just introducing this now, and it's really subtle, so make sure that you, you know, study more and get it right. But it's just trying to introduce this idea of, you know, just questioning our belief that things exist exactly the way that they appear to us, especially if it's giving rise to strong, disturbing emotion. Yeah.
But it's not, like you just said, it's not denying the fact that I'm hurting right now.
Yeah.
Like, there's not, and I think that's, for me, what happens, like, okay, if this person's empty and what they just did is empty, and I feel like I have to get rid of the fact that I'm actually in pain as a result of this encounter that we just had. And that's not, it's like I'm feeling pain right now. And that might be my momentary experience. Also empty, but like not. And I feel like for me, if I just go down that way, there's this like, okay, I'm not supposed to feel pain. And there are just, you know, and like, but that part's still my moment experience. And we're not being asked to deny that.
Yeah, Jim.
It does seem to me that what drives our need to conceptualize and to impute meaning of things at its essence comes from some level of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe right behind the fear is that nothingness or emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
What it does seem to me is that fear drives the need.
Yeah.
To make sense of.
We're more comfortable if we've got everything figured out,
yeah.
aren't we? Even if we got it figured out in a distorted way. But there is some, like the unknown is, it's, there's a discomfort there. When we, you know, we've got everything in neat little boxes and everything in this little cubby hole, even though it may probably cause more pain in the long run, but in the short term, just that anxiety of not knowing. So I think we're so quick to draw conclusions. I mean, thinking of the way that we relate to people and on the basis of such little raw data, the way someone looks, the way they drive, the first couple of sentences we hear, we got them sorted. And then we dismiss them, or, you know, it's amazing to watch that process when we meet a new person. And when we take in that raw data of the sound and the look and everything, and then we've got them categorized. And we can be completely missing out on these totally amazing people because we've just put them in some category of like, oh, this is somebody that I want to have a relationship with. Yeah, but I think you're right, that fear and the discomfort.
But I think behind the fear is a sense of a fear of nothingness or
non-existence. And our mind works in categories. So we're never going to not do that. So we don't have to worry about somehow all we're going to see is like pixels of unrelated to like whatever. I mean, we never have to worry about that. We are, you know, because I think that is the fear. And then there's the fear, because by the way, the main object of our emptiness meditation is ourselves. How do we exist independent on these three levels of dependence, so that we're not, there's no inherently existent Jan. And we think there's something in us findable that's us, our real essence in there somewhere. We even think it's here, or sometimes we think it's here. And so examining, how do we exist independent on causes and conditions? Jan exists independent on the, you know, sperm and egg of her parents, and then the nutrition and the education and all that went into making her body and mind what it is right now, the constituent parts, arms, legs, torso, all the way down to the cellular, molecular, subatomic parts. And then on top of that, and there's 30 different Jans in this room, because we all have our conceptual imputation that we're imputing on those constituent parts. And that's the only way that Jan exists. There is no Jan. There is no Jan. There is no essence of Jan. And it doesn't feel that way. So the most important application is, can we relate to ourselves as a process instead of a fixed entity? We're a process of moments of body and mind, a continuum of body, continuum of mind, changing moment by moment by moment, with a label me slapped on top of it. That's all. Doesn't feel that way, does it? When someone insults you, how dare you insult me? Process with a label slapped on top of it? Does it feel that way? No way, right? It feels like there's something there that we need to protect and defend and build up. I mean, look at our attachment and aversion. Who are we attached to? The people that compliment us and laugh at our jokes and think we're cute and feed our ego. Who do we have aversion to? The people that insult us and don't pay attention to us and ignore us. So it's like our constant job is trying to prop up this sense of self that doesn't, that we don't even exist like that. What a waste of time. And that's what we call life. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? And it doesn't even exist. We're just a process. And because our mind stream goes on until enlightenment, we'll never cease to exist. So we can just let go of all of that. It's like all the hard work to construct this solid identity and keep propping it up, because it's so fluid, we can feel it like, whoa, gotta keep those balls in the air, quick, you know. Because it's almost like we tune into how you know, tenuous it is and how much of a flow it is. So we're constantly having to reinforce, and Lord Buddha's just like, dude, let it go. Don't even exist like that at all. It's just like groove with the process of who you are. You know, so it's really interesting.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking as a, you know, growing up at a certain stage, you know, as a child, really the world's coming and it's like, how do I need to have an identity.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
the child goes almost from like just this pure beingness to identifying.
Yeah.
And then
right.
I need to have a functioning identity to present to the world. And it's a struggle. What am I going to be? The happy one, sad one? Oh, I don't fit. Okay, I'm going to approximate. What are the images?
Yeah.
It's so much work to construct this persona.
This persona, yeah.
And now you're saying, okay, that's not the real thing you need, but you need a persona to function in the world, to do all the stuff, operate, but
yeah.
Then
and
you're saying...
really lightly.
Yeah.
Hold it lightly.
Right.
Spaciously. We did a meditation, Fernando and Michael were here last night, and we did this meditation of deconstructing, like looking at where does my concept of me come from? And examining how much comes from my parents' stories when I was growing up that I believe my parents' story of me, how much came from other influences, how much came from maybe a defining event, like sometimes it'd be a really intense event in our life that somehow solidifies. And so we examine that, and then the people who were here last night had some interesting experiences around that of like, oh wow, I thought that was really me, and it was just some story that came from someone else, or historical, something that I identify with that's like the way I was decades ago, and I've changed so much, but I'm carrying around that identity as if it were still reality, even though that continuum has just kept on flowing. But I have this solid, concrete concept that I keep... putting on top of that flow, right? And just questioning that.
And then there's cultural identities too. There's
our
generational stuff, the collective. This is bigger than just us, right?
Well, one of the questions was, how much does your culture and your gender determine how you feel about yourself?
Yeah.
And just questioning that. Like, what are the expectations of your culture and your gender? And how much of that goes into your view of who you are?
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to function and we have a certain identity, but I think it's just holding it with this light, spacious touch is the point, and realizing it's changing all the time. So we don't have to carry... And why is it what we carry around is the garbage? Why? Like, for me, and I kind of composed the meditation that I led last night from this experience I had in this long meditation retreat. And I realized I had this wicked case of what they call imposter syndrome, right? People would be like, oh, you're smart and you're talented and you're together. You know, people would give me these jobs, and I'd be like, any minute they're going to find out that I'm a loser. You know, because I had this narrative that came from a total distortion of my dad. Like, for a long time, I was like, that was my dad's story. And then I was like, no, I totally distorted what I was getting from... But it created this story. I was like, oh my God, any minute now, they're going to find out. And just seeing how I'd taken on my father's narrative or my perception of my father, I mean, which is 3 degrees from reality, you know, and then made that this baggage I carried through life. Like, why wasn't it all the times that people complimented? No, it had to be the times I was made to feel like a loser. Like, that's what we drag along.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this process of meditation, just going, you know, my dad is just some guy. Like, I gave him so much power over my identity, and he's just some guy with his own conceptual imputation. Like, right? So it's really interesting to do that process, and there may be certain people in our lives or certain incidents. Wow, and then it gets so solid, right? Instead of being fluid. So it's super interesting to really examine in terms of our own kind of storyline about ourselves and how much is valid still. How much is historical? Can we relate to ourselves more as a process with these fresh imputations all the time? Because we're always changing, you know. So if we don't let go and kind of keep up with the process. It's like there's this one Buddhist psychologist called John Wellwood, and he was talking about how we pass along this sense of identity from one moment to the next, like a relay racer passing a baton. You know, and we just pass this concept from moment to moment in this never-ending relay race. And like, what are we passing to the next moment in our mind? And how accurate and how valid is it? So it's interesting. Okay. So we didn't get to the six perfections, but that was easy compared to this. So read about it in your reading. So yeah, I think that's more than enough to be getting on with for tonight. But just keep really thinking about these ideas. Keep thinking about these three levels of dependence arising and dependent origination, and how emptiness is the other side of the coin. Because things are dependent on these three levels of dependence, they're empty of inherent existence. So these two are like two sides of a coin. So when somebody tries to tell you that emptiness is the void, this parallel universe black hole thing, or that emptiness means nothing exists and nothing matters, tell them the truth. That emptiness is just a characteristic of every existing phenomena, which is its voidness of existing independently, inherently, you know, not depending on these three factors. That's all. That's all that emptiness is. So you can't talk about emptiness separate from the phenomena that it qualifies. It's just that every existing thing has its own emptiness, which is its own lack of existing, independent of these factors. Okay, so that's the essence. And just keep, as one of my teachers says, just keep cooking it. I've given you the raw material. Just keep cooking it. Keep studying. It's really cool. Like when you really get into it, there's a lot of wonderful texts. Everything's translated into English now. You know, there's a lot of great resources. So just kind of keep thinking of it. And at least question appearances, especially if you're having a mental affliction attack. If I could just give you one take home from the 6 weeks, question appearances, you know, especially if your peace of mind is disturbed, you know, because there's something that you're distorting about the situation. All right, so let's dedicate all of that wonderful positive energy. And so, one of my favorite quotes is by a great master called Aryadeva, and he was the disciple of Master Nagarjuna. And in his text called The 400 Stanzas, he says, even doubting that things exist in the way they appear tears samsara to shreds. So tonight, hopefully, we've generated at least a doubt in our minds that things exist exactly the way they appear. So we've created such powerful causes to bring our cyclic existence to an end, created such powerful causes to lead to our eventual liberation and enlightenment. So let's dedicate all of that positive energy towards that goal. Enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For more.
Yeah.
What are you thinking in May?
So, so in May, I was thinking because we were talking a couple of times ago about mental afflictions, so medicines and some of the antidotes to the different mental afflictions. And then Sunil and I are conspiring to co-teach maybe NBC as a spiritual path, something like that, like nonviolent communication, empathy, compassion, some jam session about all of those. And we just hit on a date of June 16th, right? Which is a Saturday, probably the afternoon, kind of, whatever. Anyway, stay tuned for that, because I've been loving Sunil's class, and I just feel like there's a lot of overlap with some of the stuff I've been doing. And then some special practice Mondays on different practices to introduce different practices, and stay tuned. Yeah.
And some social justice
nights. And some social justice nights on Fridays. I wanted to have a couple of guest speakers, maybe, and some more stuff. There's something, and by the way, on the, I put last night on the bulletin board, there's this movement starting called the Poor People's Campaign, and it was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's last campaign, right before he was assassinated, and he said we needed to move beyond civil rights to human rights. And so Reverend William Barber, who some of you may be familiar with, is mobilizing in 50 years on, picking up that campaign. And so there's going to be a lot of actions between Mother's Day and Juneteenth here in Sacramento. They picked 27 cities to focus on this political campaign. So there's an event April 16th, and unfortunately I'm not going to be here, but Brandy and Lauren are going to go. And then I wanted to try and kind of mobilize the Buddhist community around it, because they're really billing it as like a moral revival, you know, of really working on some of these social justice issues as sort of a moral calling. So I thought it would be appropriate for that.
And the 15th is at Brian Riverside Baker's Church, so when he comes on the 27th, he's quite heavily involved in this whole exact thing in Sacramento, so that can probably be part of the talk that he can
And if you want to come on the 16th, you can talk to me and Brandy, and maybe we can coordinate rides or something.
Yeah. That would be great. Great.